From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A showdown is brewing over funding for road repairs and other essentials.
$2 billion is a lot of money, and you can't shake it out of the couch cushions.
Today, economists give us best estimates of where Michigan revenues are headed, and we talk next steps for the road debate. Also today, federal tariffs on European imports pose a threat to some food and beverage businesses. We'll talk with one Michigan wine distributor. Also, we get book critic Keith Taylor's winter reading recommendations. He's got several picks, including a photo book inside the world of Aretha Franklin.
The cover photograph where she's dressed for a masked ball as Nefertiti. You look at this and you go, who else in America could get away with dressing as Nefertiti?
The book is amazing. All that and more is directly ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we go over a busy week in the news, including a major story just out on how the city of Detroit overcharged tens of thousands of people for property taxes, often at the expense of their homes. But first, state economists agreed today on a revenue forecast that'll determine the parameters for Michigan's next budget. Revenues are expected to rise slightly this fiscal year and the next one. All the while, health care costs and tax cuts continue to demand healthy slices of the budget pie. Did we mention a need to fix the roads? Zach Gorchow is the executive editor and publisher of Gongwer News Service, and Brian Calley is with the Small Business Association of Michigan. He's also a former lieutenant governor of the state, and they're with us to talk about revenues. Gentlemen, welcome to Stateside.
Great Hello.
To be with you.
Zach, how would you were at the State Revenue Forecast Conference. How would you describe the overall mood at the gathering?
I mean, I think it's pretty much been a sort of steady as she goes mentality for several years now. Not too hot, not too cold, sort of just right. It's not explosive growth, so you don't have people celebrating in the streets and figuring out how are we going to spend all this new money or rebate it to the taxpayers. And you don't have revenues falling precipitously and tension and fear about cuts. It's just sort of, okay, this looks like another budget year where we're going to have maybe some modest increases in some places where there's going to have to be restraint. And because of previous decisions, the current administration is saying there may have to be some reductions too.
Brian, reading the write-ups, it appears that corporate income tax was pretty strong. Does that say anything about what's going right with Michigan's economy right now?
The expansion continues, and one of the reasons I think there's a little bit more optimism now than, say, this time last year, some of the question marks have been taken off the table. I mean, Michigan is very reliant on trade with, particularly across North America, and having the USMCA, the successor to NAFTA, passed through the House of Representatives gives a little more assurance on what that looks like. Some progress made on a trade agreement and potentially ending the trade war with China is another question mark taken off the table. The fact that the strike at General Motors didn't carry over to the other major automakers, all of those things that in the past had given some pause or some reason for concern have moved in positive directions. So I think you put those all together, and there's more confidence that this expansion is going to continue.
One more thing about revenues. This was the year that cannabis sales became legal. I couldn't help but wonder, did either of you hear anything about cannabis making much of a ripple?
Well, there's definitely a lot of action out there in entrepreneurs and business people getting involved and starting things up, but it's not going to be a huge revenue generator for the state. It will make some impact, but when you consider the size of the overall revenue streams, it's not going to compete with income tax or sales tax or anything like that.
One of the things people have been saying is that growth is slowing, but that no recession is in sight for the upcoming fiscal years. This kind of feels like something that no economist wants to vocalize about, but that just about every layperson in the state might have on their minds. Was there any more specific information? Zach, did you hear anything about prospects for a recession or that no, there definitely won't be one?
Well, a couple things. One, I would agree with what the lieutenant governor said, that there's more optimism now. You don't have these trade question marks hanging over things like there was before. But that said, I've covered a lot of these revenue conferences, and I've never heard them outright predict there will be a recession in the coming year. It's usually a lot like what we've heard, which is growth is either going really well or we expect growth to continue, but it's slowing. Typically, what happens is by the time you get a revenue conference where things are not good, it's already clear the economy is sinking, maybe unemployment is going up, and revenues are falling, and the revenue conference is just trying to get a sense of how bad is it. It's really unusual, and I personally can't recall a revenue conference where they said, we expect a recession in the coming year.
What kind of year might this be for expenditures? Was there any talk about how much the state expects to spend?
I mean, I think it's looking like, again, sort of just incremental inflationary increases. The general fund really hasn't changed in size in a fundamental way in the last 15 to 20 years for a variety of reasons. So that means that, you know, there's been maybe at best inflationary increases available. For that, you know, the school aid fund will be up a little bit, not a lot. There might be, a little bit of money there for a very minor increase to the schools. I don't think anybody's expecting any big investments. And the big question is, you know, there's a lot more money that that's going to be spent and by law must be spent on roads from the general fund this coming year, another $100 million plus from what there is now,
mm-hmm.
Among a lot of other commitments, rising Medicaid caseloads, so forth. And that limits the ability to say, you know what, we're going to do a big grand new program and we have all this money to spend on it, because that's just not there.
Brian, would you expect to see leaders trying to restore some of the money that Governor Whitmer vetoed over the summer when she and the legislature were at fighting over the budget?
I think there will be, early this year, there'll be some attempt at a supplemental to potentially restore a few things. Clearly, the governor had a few priorities that, including community college and the Reconnect program. There was also a veto of Going Pro, which is skilled trades training program, is really quite popular with the business community. And of course, the Pure Michigan ad campaign. Those are all things that I think are very much in play. And as a supplemental is considered, will likely be on the table. And I think that there's good potential for a deal. It's just start out of a new year. They put a budget agreement together at the end of last year, and even though it was quite contentious, if there's a time of year to get something done, it's this time.
Right. About that budget fight, the governor and the legislature still have not agreed going forward to a funding stream for road repairs that might address the problem to the fullness that both sides had hoped. What do you think is the tipping point, perhaps, Brian, for looking at the state's package of economic stimulus as it stands and the outstanding needs for infrastructure and operations like roads and needs in the general fund and saying it's time to dial back what we're doing with incentives?
Well, it's going to take compromise to come to an agreement. There are some differences that on their face appear to be irreconcilable differences between the starting points, at least the previous starting point of the governor and where legislative leaders were. I think it's going to be important that people consider an incremental approach. There is more going toward roads than there ever has been in the past, and even though it wasn't as much as our previous Governor Snyder wanted, it was something that did start moving things in the right direction. Now, had Governor Snyder held out for his original request, chances are there wouldn't be an extra $1 billion a year going into roads, and that's where I think the real story is what's the real target here. And if anything was learned from last year and just the contentious nature of it, I'm hope that it is that the parties approach the discussion with a little more flexibility.
Right. Zach, would you expect to see the governor and the legislature come to a similar point over this question of how to fund the roads next time around?
You know, it's really hard to say what's going to happen. The governor is going to have a new proposal of some sort. I'd expect it to be rolled out either in the State of the State speech later this month or in her budget presentation at the beginning of February. And I think the lieutenant governor laid it out well in that the governor last year made a very concerted effort to say, we're not going to do incrementalism. If we're going to raise taxes, if we're going to go big, we're going to go for what is needed to solve the problem, which was more than $2 billion in new funding per year, which basically every study says that's what is needed at this point. The problem is the shock value of the 45 cent per gallon gasoline tax increase that she proposed, it just simply died immediately. I mean, it just never had any support in the legislature, not really from anybody with a D or an R next to their name, and especially the Republicans who control the legislature. So now I think it's a really interesting decision for the governor. Does she now say, you know what, yes, we do need $2.2 billion, but we got to get something. Is $800 million for a first step, $1 billion for a first step, would that be enough? You know, it's a challenge because you want to tell folks we are working on solving the problem. Of course, if, you know, people drive around the corner and they hit a pothole, they think you haven't solved the problem, even if you fixed hundreds of miles of road elsewhere.
Right.
So we'll just have to see. It's going to be a feeling out process. Is there a tax increase that Republicans can support? I don't know that there is. You know, there might be some real nif-naw kinds of things they could do. But they haven't been willing, at least in this term, to do that. They did a few years ago, the package the lieutenant governor mentioned. If the answer to that question is no, then this is going to be another goose egg for this term.
Either of you, I wondered if you heard anything that surprised you this time around, either in terms of economic news or proposals on the horizon. It's when things are going well, there tends to be if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of mentality. But was there anything bold out there on the table?
I don't know that I would call it a surprise because the word had sort of leaked out about it. But I do think it's interesting. It's a time of growth, a time of historically low unemployment, yet the administration is saying we are asking our department directors to propose some cuts because of these general fund pressures due to other expenditures. So a little bit of a different take, potential cuts during a time of growth.
Zach Gorchow is the executive editor and publisher of Gongwer News Service. We've also heard from Brian Calley of the Small Business Association of Michigan, a former lieutenant governor under Rick Snyder. Guys, thank you very much. We appreciate your checking in.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Coming up, Aretha Franklin in words and pictures.
The cover photograph where she's dressed for a masked ball as Nefertiti. You look at this and you go, who else in America could get away with dressing as Nefertiti?
The poetry of Detroit music and more reads to defrost with next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Maybe the best thing about getting the holidays behind us is finding time to escape to someplace quiet and bury yourself in a book. Especially with the heavy weather moving through this weekend, seems like it's going to be a fantastic weekend for reading. Keith Taylor is a poet, writer, and teacher, retired from the U of M's creative writing program, and he stops in to talk books with us every now and then. Keith, welcome back. How are you?
Good. How are you?
How was your holiday?
Mine was good. How about yours?
It was great. Is anybody crazy enough to buy you a book as a present, knowing how many books you probably already have?
Not many. It's too bad. I wish I got more books. But when people do, it's often a problem.
Well, why don't you tell us about one of the three books that you brought in to share today?
Okay. The first one I want to talk about is a book of photographs, which is tough to talk about on the radio, right? But it's called The Queen Next Door. It's by a reporter and photographer named Linda Solomon. The subtitle is Aretha Franklin, An Intimate Portrait. And it's got an interesting personal history to it. Solomon got to know Aretha when the singer came back to Detroit in the early 80s to help take care of her father. Her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, had been shot in an assassination attempt and went into a coma for several years before he died. So Aretha came back to help the family. Solomon was a columnist with the Detroit News, and Aretha was famously cautious around reporters.
How in the world did Solomon get this kind of access?
Well, for whatever reason, and I'm trying to think what this was, and I think it puzzles her too from what I can tell in the text in this book, clearly they just hit it off. And Aretha
felt something, it might be chemistry, like between husband and wife, you know, like, or between President Obama and Pete Sousa, who photographed him. I mean, clearly they had something going on, other than words. And I think that happened with her and Solomon. I think Aretha might have also felt Solomon's discretion, and she's very discreet. For instance, in this book, Aretha never looks bad. The photographs aren't fancied up. They're not filtered. They're not photoshopped.
There are candids.
They're candids, but she's always well-dressed.
Yeah.
One of the few times she's not well-dressed is when she's sort of dressing casually with her rehearsal with James Brown.
Right.
But even casual with James Brown, Aretha looks great.
Right.
You know, she's not messing around.
You know, the word that comes to mind with this book, there are backstage pictures, there are onstage pictures, there are, pictures with friends and family. But the word that comes to mind is just sumptuous.
Exactly.
There is such a range of emotion and just snapshots of Black life that are just amazing to see in this
book. And Detroit life, all those politicians, all the musicians. And, you know, there's a few white musicians in there, too. She recorded with the Rolling Stones. And so there's an interesting picture of Aretha and Keith Richards, which I'd certainly never seen before.
What are some of your favorite moments in the book?
The cover photograph, which is atypical of the book, but where she's dressed for a masked ball as Nefertiti. And you look at this and you go, who else in America could get away with dressing as Nefertiti? I mean, nobody that I come, even some of the sort of wonderfully regal pop performers we have now, nobody but Aretha could have done that. And she just looks, you know, she looks fabulous. And then there's some of the ones, you know, I mean, if you live in this area long enough, you've heard lots of stories about her family, brothers and sisters, and people she worked with. And it's fun to see some of those pictures. And some of the pictures of the previous mayors, those are fun to see too. The commentary, Solomon's commentary, is very crisp, very short, and to the point. She seems to, it's mostly the 80s and early 90s, and then there are not a lot of pictures later on. Solomon was invited to the funeral and the memorial services and apparently took pictures there, but they're not in the book. She says in there at one point that most of my pictures are in the Aretha Franklin archive. So maybe that's the place where we're going to see Aretha angry or without makeup or, you know, kicking up her heels a little. But we don't see that in this book. In this book, Aretha is the queen, which is kind of what we want her to be.
It's gorgeous. I kind of wanted to buy this for myself as the gift that I didn't get over the holidays.
There you go. Yeah, you should.
So the next book you brought, Respect, is a collection, actually, not specific to Aretha Franklin, that really gets at the global impact of Detroit's music scene, including Motown and beyond. It's a book of lyrics and poems. How do you describe the sensibility uniting this book?
Well, it's Detroit, and it's the history of music in Detroit. Certainly goes back, at least touches into the early 20th century with some blues. And things. There are famous people. By the way, I just love the fact that the book on Detroit music is R-E-S-P-E-C-T. That just is I want to reiterate that. That's so right. The editors are Jim Daniels and M.L. Liebler, both longtime poets, natives of Detroit, been around for a long time. So you've got, in this book, you've got lyrics by some of the great songwriters, Fats Domino, Billy Bragg, Robbie Robertson, Gordon Lightfoot, Jack White, Eminem, and a bunch of others. Mm-hmm. Then there's some poems of the great dead poets of Detroit, Robert Hayden, for instance, Philip Levine. Then there are poets of big national reputations who are either from Detroit or have come through here and spent time here.
Nikki Giovanni,
Toy Derricotte,
sure.
Edward Hirsch, who's the president of this Guggenheim Foundation, and then there's a bunch of the rest of us who just sort of hang out here,
including you,
including me,
right.
Which is very generous of them to put in. And of course, we're happy. I mean, my 28-year-old daughter is deeply impressed that I'm in a book with Eminem. You know, you got to take what you can get when you're a poet in America.
So. Right. Could you pick one for us that you liked? Maybe a poem by someone you knew or someone
sure.
You
this
didn't.
Is this is by Ken Mikulowski, who's still around. He's getting aged now. Oh, he'd hate me to say that. But it's a lovely poem of that time in the late '60s when things were so crazy in Detroit, and there were bands, the MC5 he talks about in here. Iggy Pop was around, he talks about in here. I mean, you know, it's kind of like the precursors of punk were all in Detroit. It was after the riots. Detroit was tough. Detroit prided itself on tough. One of the great performance spaces was called the Grandy Ballroom. And it's the Grandy Ballroom's all through this book because it's a lot of the great performances. It's still, the building still exists. It's one of the buildings that nobody's decided to do anything with yet, but one hopes that they will because it's a pretty impressive building. And I just find this poem very funny. It feels very Detroit to me. So Ken Michalowski, At the Grandy Ballroom, 1968. John Sinclair, poet and manager of the MC5, asks other poets to read at the Grandy between sets. Tonight, I get to be the intermission. The Stooges are the opening act. Iggy cuts himself up and bleeds all over the audience. They love it and go nuts and can't calm down. Brother J.C. Crawford calls out, and now a poet will read some poems. Most everyone boos and retreats to the parking lot to smoke some dope. That leaves me to read a couple of poems about life, love, and revolution. One of the few remaining members of the crowd yells, "F the revolution, bring on the MC5. Someone drops a drum on stage, and on that note, my reading is over. Just to imagine reading poems between Iggy and the MC5. It's just, it terrifies me, even the thought of it.
I'm sure it seemed like an awesome idea at the time.
I bet it did, too. Yeah, yeah.
Well, were there songs or artists that this book opened up for you in a little bit different way? I mean, there's a piece in there, Unreadable on a Family Radio Station by the late Jim Gustafson, that left me with a profoundly different view of the Stooges as frustrated and like trying to engage with the world.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are lots of those things. I mean, for instance, I've listened to Eminem a fair amount. I saw the movie 8 Mile and admired it, still do, just rewatched it again a couple months ago. But to read the lyrics to the 8 Mile song in here, where I can slow down and I can go back and read a line, I kind of get what, you know, young people have known for how old is that song now, 15 years?
Yeah.
Maybe more. Got a long time ago that was really lyrically complex.
We've been talking about some of the works that refer to the punk roots of in Detroit and you know, the hip hop era. There's a great poem in there by Nandi Comer, who's, you know, obviously one of the younger people on the scene right now. But there's also a lot of deep Detroit history in here. You brought a sort of period piece to this collection.
It's interesting. That's what the editor called it too. How did you know that?
I didn't. Oh. It's called Detroit Dancing 1948. You want to set this poem up for us?
Yeah, this is I married into Detroit 40 years ago. And my late father-in-law, who didn't particularly like me, I wasn't the image of who his daughter should marry, but he was from Detroit, Near East Side, and grew up there in the Polish neighborhood. It's all gone now. It's all the Med Center. And he had some stories about Detroit. And when he died, I felt these stories are going to go with him. You know, some of them I want to save. And this one I did. This one I was able to pull out and get something out of it, and about his life in the years just after the war. Detroit Dancing, 1948. In Memoriam, Leo Golis. Everyone home from the war with stories to tell, except me, of course, just a bit too young to know the horrors of Iwo, Normandy, the Bulge. I spent the duration peddling popcorn outside a theater on Gratiot, later groceries at the market. No woman would be wowed by any yarn I could spin, and I'd never win a turkey with my looks. You see, everyone needs an angle. At the Polish National Alliance in Hamtramck, the women gathered dutifully around their returning heroes, wide-eyed in the presence of such courage. But when they danced alone, their arms circling the smoke from 100 cigarettes. With luck, one might find another woman anxious to show her grace. Think of it, years spent watching two women, 19 or 20, sway each other over the stained floor. So I taught myself dancing downstairs at home in the old neighborhood, humming Moonlight Serenade for rhythm, waltzing the broom, my partner, from coal bin to canning jars, learning to finish with a flourish, dipping its bristled head gently toward the cement, until I could walk into any club, anywhere in the city, pick out any woman, turn her once across the floor, and if I didn't sweep her off her feet, I hear at least, and this was almost enough then, that I was certainly light on mine.
That's such an amazing image of the two women dancing each other across the floor.
It is. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Absent the actual presence or absent the attention of men home from the war.
Yeah, just wanting to dance.
I really can't believe the chutzpah that it took to take on this project. I mean, covering everything from jazz giants who happened to be in Detroit, Miles Davis, Cannonball Adderley, and homegrown people like Farouk Bey.
Yes, Farouk's in there. It's great.
The intense, intense, you know, history of Motown. There are just some fabulous poems in here related to that period.
Yeah, and the editor, particularly M.L. Liebler, Jim Daniels even gives him credit for this, is just fearless. He wants to get an Eminem song. He doesn't say, oh, he's going to charge me $20,000. He just writes him and say, we're doing this thing about Detroit. And Eminem goes, yeah, of course I want to be in it. Jack White stood right up, gave us, we did the launch of this book at Jack Wright's Third Man. And it was like, he gave us the space. We had 150 people in there reading the poems.
We're talking with Keith Taylor about three reads to get your January started properly. The third selection you brought is
very different.
It's not music from Michigan per se.
She's from Michigan. I think she's actually from Greater Detroit, but she lives in Grand Rapids, teaches at a college over there. Caitlin Horrocks. It's a historical novel about Erik Satie. So,
The Vexations.
And this takes place in Paris, the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. It's a recreation of a very troubled life. Satie was wacko. Lived in this one little place out in the what were the suburbs. When somebody went in it after he died, it was a hoarder house, what we'd think of as a hoarder house. Smelled terrible. He'd come out dressed to the, dressed as impeccably in his one suit that he wore day in, day out. And then he'd go off and work in the cabarets in way over on the right bank.
He lived in the suburbs of Paris, you
say? He did, in the northern suburbs, yeah.
Sure.
And then he'd come in. Sometimes he didn't have enough money to come in. Mm-hmm. And then he would compose these exquisite little pieces. The Gymnopédie, which I suspect is where Caitlin Horrocks first ran across him. Little, very simple piano pieces that just have a few notes but are so evocative. If people don't put the name on that music, if they listen to the music, I suspect they recognize it. Oh, yeah, I heard that in an elevator one time. It's stuff that's around, like the air we breathe. It's like, oh, what's that? Well, somebody wrote it. This crazy guy living in Paris. And Caitlin Horrocks has written this sort of wonderful historical novel that tries to figure out how that happened.
We know Satie for the style that he developed, just busting out of the Romantic period with simple, austere gorgeousness that has been used in film after film after film.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And really paved the way for a more contemporary idea of music. How would you say Horrocks is she providing us some kind of parallel in her prose as she tells the family story that's at the heart of this narrative? How do you describe her approach?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there with the family narrative. It's a portrait of genius, but it's a portrait of what genius does to the people around it. Those people who are his vexations, his family, his siblings, the one woman who loves him for a short time anyway. These people have found a way to support him, although he gives nothing back. So it's this, don't love genius because genius won't love you back. Genius is too self-absorbed. Has to be too self-absorbed. And I think it's partly that story and then how it comes. She has a lovely phrase, which it's wonderful to quote. She says that the notes he came up with become so ubiquitous that they are nearly white noise. And then they catch your ear and are beautiful all over again. They are wallpaper that can make you cry. And I love that, you know, just sort of the music in the backgrounds of our lives. But if we take a second and hear a couple of notes, it's like, what is that? It's beautiful, you know. How does it happen? I mean, that's the mystery of it. It's so,
That's gorgeous.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's such an interesting snapshot, too, into Satie's world, someone who is a contemporary of Picasso and Jean Cocteau and everything that was happening in Paris at that time.
Yeah, and he was very central to it, too. I mean, those people were around Montmartre where he was, and you know, they all influenced each other.
Keith, before you go, we've just rolled into 2020, and I personally have ingested about all of the best of the decade lists I could possibly handle.
Oh, that's
handle.
Tough, isn't it? Yeah. Oh.
But I was curious, when you think about the books of the past 10 years, are there books, perhaps by Michigan writers or on Michigan themes, that you think we will still be talking about in another 10 years?
Oh, wow. I wish I had more time to think about that. You're catching me off guard.
Or just stuff that lit your world on fire.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I mean, the book that's sticking in my mind, the title's even going to escape me, but Carolyn Forché, who is originally a poet, originally from Michigan, she wrote a memoir about the year she spent as a young woman in Central America when Central America was torn apart by death squads and civil war. And that book just grabbed me and sort of tore me apart. The title is by Carolyn Forché, and the title is, if I'm remembering correctly, is What You Have Heard Is True, which comes from a poem of hers, very famous prose poem about the horrors of those wars.
Well, that sounds amazing, too, and another one to add to the bookshelf. Keith Taylor, thank you for stopping in and talking to us about books today.
My pleasure. I hope we get to do it again. It's fun.
Still to come on Stateside, it's been a wild 7 days, and we're going to go over some of the week's top stories with our news roundtable. Also, what new tariffs on European imports could mean for food and beverage in Michigan. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. President Donald Trump has proposed up to 100% tariffs on European wine. That means that consumers would be asked to pay double the current price tag for wines imported from Europe. The public comment period on that proposal ends next week. And then, who knows? There's been a great deal of confusion and angst in the food and beverage industries, including at Little Guy Wine Company, a wine wholesaler in Southeast Michigan. Here with us to explain how a trade dispute between Trump and France might impact business here at home is Elisa Weber-Santin, sales manager at Little Guy Wine Company. Elisa, welcome.
Thank you.
What would 100% tariffs mean for your business?
100% tariffs would be devastating to our business. We sell 85% imported wines, maybe a little more, and those are entirely European. When you think about 100% tariff, it's not something that can be absorbed. You can't take a wine that you've been paying, let's say, $20 for at the store and suddenly pay $40 for it. No one's going to do that. And so people like us who are in the business of bringing those wines to the stores and to the restaurants are simply not going to be able to bring those in because we can't sit on wine that we are not going to be able to sell.
Where is the angst being felt? What are you hearing among your clients?
It's taking a little longer to filter through the system. I think those of us who are closer to where this is going to affect us. So importers and distributors are feeling it more because we are already feeling the effects of the 25% tariffs on the French wines that went into play in October. So inventory that we already had was not affected by that, but stuff that we've gotten in since then is starting to filter through. And so the prices are starting to go up. Now, a 25% increase is hard and it's not ideal. It takes some adjusting, but can probably be weathered, but 100% cannot. We're just simply not able to bring in stuff that will then cost twice as much or more.
Wine prices are already subject to some flux, given that some restaurants need to adjust wine prices to cover the cost of paying their staff and doing other things. So what does that mean when a restaurant is getting wine with a hefty tariff on it and trying to figure out how to absorb that cost?
It's pretty complex. I think there people are going to have to sort of rebrand if large tariffs go into place. I think a restaurant that is selling mostly European wine is going to have to think, what can we do differently? Do we need to buy wine from different countries? Do we need to focus on different types of, you know, alcohol programs, like work on our spirits program more or look into cider? Or, you know, the problem is that ultimately the consumer is really going to have, you know, the problem because they're going to have a lack of choice. I think some people think, well, you know, people are going to say, I'm not going to pay that much for wine, so I'll drink something else. They're not going to even have the opportunity to because the wine's just not going to be there.
Well, I mean, there is a pretty healthy domestic wine market right now. What would you say to someone who thinks there are plenty of great wines produced right here in the U.S. along the West Coast? Who cares if European wines get too expensive? Maybe it's time to expand our interest in Michigan wines.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that is a valid point. And I think we would see a small boost in domestic wine sales and Michigan, which could be good. The problem is there's just simply not enough production. If no one brings in European wines make up over 50% of the wine imported into the United or wine produced in the world. And so America is the number one consumer of wine. If you suddenly couldn't get all that European wine anymore, or it was too expensive and didn't make sense, and people could only drink American wine, there simply wouldn't be enough of it.
Elisa, thanks for coming in and talking to us about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elisa Weber-Satin is a sales manager for Little Guy Wine Company. It has been a completely action-packed week, and if I may just take a moment and say what a huge pleasure and privilege it's been to experience it with you as stateside new host, it is time for our weekly news roundtable. So let's dive in on the week that was. Bill Nowling is a partner at Lambert and a former Republican Party operative. He's with us in studio today. Hey, Bill.
Hey, how you doing?
And Nancy Kaffer is an editorial page writer at the Detroit Free Press. Nancy, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get right out of the gate with a huge Detroit story that just broke as we were getting ready today. The Detroit News reports the city overcharged residents on their property taxes for many years. This was not a small bookkeeping error. The story says that the overcharges totaled $600 million and forced thousands of people into debt and in some cases out of their homes as the city foreclosed. Nancy, you've been following tax foreclosures and property tax debt for some time now. Is there any way for Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan to make this right?
Boy, that's a lead right with the big question here. you know, I think it would be incredibly difficult to do that because, number one, like you said, some people have perhaps lost their homes. We know people have lost their homes to tax foreclosure based on inflated assessments. And if you have lost your home, it has been auctioned off. It's either now occupied or quite likely derelict because that happens to a lot of homes that are auctioned in the tax foreclosure auction.
You can't just walk this process back.
You can't simply take that back. You know, there needs to be, you could handle the tax debt that may have been accumulated because of this by adopting what it's called the retroactive poverty property tax exemption. Folks who live in poverty are not required in Detroit to pay any property tax, but this is an application-only exemption, and far fewer people are receiving this than we know are qualified for it. So they could do that. Duggan has been reluctant to adopt that solution because he says it's not fair to people who did pay their taxes. I disagree. Mm. There's a solution to that part. But for people who lost their homes, yeah, you can't take them back.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, during the Detroit bankruptcy, I mean, we
saw that the assessments were at least double what the actual market value was. And there was some talk at that time about just zeroing them out down to a base level and making that the new normal.
But would that be just in the service of making sure that everybody knew what the properties were worth, what they were worth?
No, making sure that they were actually assessed at the true market value instead of being over-assessed. But the mayor rightly notes, there's no easy solution, because to do that, you would have to take almost $500 million off the tax roll that the city needs to just to do its numbers in bankruptcy. But that's a terrible
justification.
But the issue is that, you know, this is what you're seeing here with the assessments, and it is a problem that needs to be dealt with. But it's one of the series of problems that government has been making for years about, well, we're running out of tax revenue, so we'll just change the decimal point where we value property at to generate more money to make up that difference, instead of coming up with a more holistic approach to some tax equity in the process.
Not a practice that's limited to Detroit by any means.
No, absolutely not.
Well, there's been so much emphasis on making the city functional again. Bill, what does this situation say about the balance of restoring operations and a sense of normalcy versus the human toll that enforcement takes?
Well, I think, I think it just reinforces that's always the tension and the balance that you have to work at. I mean, I don't think anybody goes into a situation saying, you know, how can we take more money from people just to take more money from people? They're trying to solve a problem and come up with solutions to provide services. So I do think that the intentions are in some respect are good, but the outcomes are bad. And the longer that we let them sit as bad, and I'm not trying to pass the buck because we didn't deal with it during the bankruptcy either. The longer we let it sit, the more people who are on the extreme of the margin suffer because of it.
I think there's a bigger issue here, which is the lack of people in power listening to residents of non-white, non-affluent communities. You had people in Flint saying, hey, our water looks terrible and you can't drink it. It smells bad. It makes us sick. And folks going, now we think it's all right. You have people in Detroit saying, hey, you know, I'm paying taxes on a house that you say is worth $60,000. My neighborhood has been hit. It's one of two houses on the block. There haven't been sales in my neighborhood for whatever long. And if I tried to sell it for $52,000, no one would buy it. My realtor would laugh if I proposed this. And so we have to start paying attention to things that people in communities of color that are not affluent tell us, because they're telling us the truth about their lives.
We got to move on. Governor Gretchen Whitmer's State of the State address is coming right up, scheduled for January 29th. We hear that she's getting ready to propose a bond to help fund road repairs, an issue that she campaigned on extensively. Bill, you've worked in the legislature. Do you feel like that possibility represents a step forward or a step back?
I think that it's tantalizing to say we can do this by going to Wall Street and say, fund this, we will do this. And that gets us around the politics of having to pass a bill to raise taxes to get more revenue funding. But, I'm a little leery of governments bonding to do what they should do. Bonding their way through operations and investment that they should do with tax levies, because that's what the taxes are supposed to do. You know, Detroit got into a lot of problems by forestalling payments to pensions by going to the market to fund it so that they could put more money back into city services. And that eventually came back to bite them. And, you know, my sons and daughters are going to pay for my roads now if we bond for them now. And they're going to pay for it anyways. But who's going to pay for their roads when that – we got to come up with a different way to fund it.
I 100% agree with you. You shouldn't bond out for regular operational expenses that should be financed via a tax levy. But our legislature is absolutely opposed to raising taxes to fix the roads. I haven't heard anyone really arguing about the $2 billion a year that's needed to fix the roads figure. People seemed, this was a figure derived by former Republican Governor Rick Snyder, former governor, not former Republican. so far as we know. And, you know, so this is a number that's real. We all drive around on our roads. We see in bridges. We see the condition that they're in. And you still have the Senate Majority Leader saying stuff like, I don't know, new revenue is necessary. Well, $2 billion is a lot of money, and you can't shake it out of the couch cushions. We should be raising taxes to pay for it. You know, if we're not going to do that, what are the other options aside from bonding?
Do we see the Republicans in control of the legislature going for something like this?
Oh, no.
No, I don't think so. I think they're skeptical of bonding and incurring that much debt for...
They're skeptical of bonding, and they're skeptical of raising taxes. So,
yeah. Well, I should say they're skeptical. There's nothing skeptical about their disdain for raising taxes. I think that that's more.
So what's the other option to get money?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we could go to the ballot. You know, that's an option that we could do. It's not a perfect option, but you know, other groups have done that when the political process is ground down. Mm-hmm. To do that. So I think that there's an opportunity to do that. But, you know, short of just saying we need more money for roads, and I think that that's an agreement, the problem is the formula and the way that we do it is so it's like 75 years old. And mm-hmm. every year, more electric cars drive more miles that are not being taxed, and that's going to eventually catch up.
But that's still like electric cars are such a teeny tiny fraction of the vehicles on the road.
All right, well, let's just talk about the...
That's like 2050's problems. Well, sure. Let's talk 2020's problem now, and let's work on...
Are you sure they're not the same problem?
Well, it's the same problem, but even if you take electric cars off of this, look at how much more fuel efficient cars are. Cars are driving farther on same amount or less amount of energy and fuel to do that.
Well, don't make it a gas tax, but it has to be a tax.
Well, I don't think people disagree with that, but I think we've got to tackle that now. We're dealing with a funding situation that's 75 years old. We need to modernize we need to do with our transportation infrastructure.
Bill, you know I respect you, but I have no patience for the electric cars argument. Like, look at the numbers. I looked it up. It's a tiny. It's not even like a percent. Maybe I don't know.
I gotta drag us back. If there's one local story that has captured the hearts and minds of everyone in the new year, I'm guessing it's that green ooze that leaked out onto I-696 in Madison Heights. The neon-colored ooze turned out to be hexavalent chromium, the stuff at the center of the now-famous Aaron Brockovich water contamination story. Now, the owner of the site at the source of contamination is in prison. Some lawmakers are saying that the State Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy dropped the ball protecting the public. Nancy, who do you think is to blame here?
Wow. Well, I haven't run these numbers, but I'm pretty sure that if we looked at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the EPA over decades, we would find that they're never staffed and funded enough. You know, we have one of the things about this site is this site, we know about it because green ooze got out onto 696, but there's sites all over our state. We think of big plants like the Marathon plant as being a big pollution plant, but there's all these small industrial areas that are filled with things that aren't good for us, and we really have to start taking stock of that.
Yeah, you know, and I think that, I mean, having, you know, done some work on the Flint issue, I know that if you look hard enough in the emails, you're going to find some people talking about the potential liability and threats for this particular site because it's not unknown to them. They've regulated it. It doesn't. But the bigger issue is that, you know, for years, we let people bury stuff legally mm-hmm. because there was either no law or the law was pretty loose about how to do that. And those places are all over the state. Those supposedly capped landfills that were supposed to keep everything
under wraps.
Now, this stuff is leaking out of it and leaking into the groundwater. It's a huge issue. Michigan's doing better at trying to put its arms around that, but it's leap years ahead of other states, but it's a huge problem in terms of we just don't know what was buried in the ground 50, 60 years ago.
Well, like we had, you know, just before the ooze, we had that dock on the Detroit River that collapsed that had...
contaminated with uranium.
Yes. I mean, that's just another... just in a few short weeks, we had these things where stuff had been stocked away somewhere and not addressed.
So clearly, the number of sites with potential questions is more than we could count if we spent the rest mm-hmm. of the hour on it. How do we balance protecting the public from these harmful chemicals while not overburdening companies that might have choices to take their business elsewhere?
Well, I think the first thing that we have to do is get past the idea that environmental regulations just kill jobs and burden employers. I mean, they're there to keep us safe, and we have to balance our safety. I frankly think the scale should tilt toward our safety. I mean, if we don't have clean air and clean water, the whole business piece is kind of moot, right?
Yeah, I don't think businesses want what everybody else wants. They want, a good place. They want people happy, healthy, engaged in the economic enterprise and buying their products and helping them make money. So, I mean, it's in their interest to do that. I think what we need to do is come up with ways and make it a priority to fund those ways to help do that, whether that is through bonding or other types of financial things to do that, but to help companies that follow the law 50 years ago, take out of the ground what's in there now.
Bill, I'm so happy to hear your pro-tax stance.
Guys, we got to go. Bill Nowling is a partner at Lambert. He has done work for the Michigan Republican Party. Nancy Kaffer is a columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Happy New Year, both of you. Thanks for being here.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Before we let you go today, let us note that this day, January 10th, is an infamous one for many sports fans in Michigan. It was on this day back in 1964, William Clay Ford bought the Detroit Lions for $6 million. Since then, the team has won a total of, is this right? One playoff game since then. That's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.